This is October 15th, 1996.
Greetings, Evergreen.
Greetings, man.
I was rereading an early Evergreen's transcript from the, probably around 77 or 78 on Lemuria. I think it was called Lemuria, A Home.
Yes.
And it talked about, at the same time I reread the reading on Atlantis, The Beginnings.
Yes.
And it talked about the metaphor of Atlantis. Atlantis was the altering by the Buddhis in 27,500. That was the first Atlantis.
Yes.
In the reading. Of course, I read those transcripts back in the early 80s and haven't looked at them since. And I can see a lot more in them now, knowing what I know over the last few years about the alteration. I don't even think Beth and those that were at those readings knew that fact. Because the way it's read about Atlantis, it's sort of vague about... It does talk about the altering, but it doesn't give the details.
Exactly.
Right. So it's loaded when you reread it.
Yes.
In retrospect. But what was interesting is in the Lemurian thing, Lemurian reading, they talked about the early people in Lemuria from 18,000 B.C. to 14,000 B.C., I think it was. And then they moved over to North America, and some moved to Asia. But when it then talks about, and when those that moved to North America then go to what becomes the Atlantis of 10,000 or 15,000 B.C. But what's interesting is that in the course of the reading on Atlantis or Lemuria, I can't remember which, it talks about us coming out of Africa. That's assumed in the reading. Now, according to our readings that I've done the last couple of years, the Buddhians took Cro-Magnon, altered man, and distributed them around the world. Distributed these altered beings around the altered humans around the world, which began the different races. Now, how do I reconcile us coming out of Africa, but then being deposited around? How does that relate to a civilization popping up in Lemuria before North America and Asia?
Understand, where did man come from? Where did man begin?
Right. I just remember the other thought is that they say we went from Africa over to Asia and then to Lemuria. That's the stream.
The stream.
Right?
Yes.
But that's on the simple level. What about the fact that I think it took them 2 years for the Buddhists to lift these Cro-Magnon people, I think, in Africa to other parts of the world? Isn't that what they say?
Approximately, yes.
So we began from Africa.
Yes.
In the sense, that's where the man that was altered was Neanderthal and became Cro-Magnon.
Became Proto-Man, yes.
And Neanderthal man is unaltered Cro-Magnon man or Proto-Man.
Exactly.
Right, so we all came from Neanderthal man.
Yes, the divergence created the man that is now.
Right, the Cro-Magnon is altered, has been altered by the Buddhians.
Yes.
So when archaeologists, paleontologists look at humanity, at Neanderthal man from say 30,000 BC back to 60,000 BC, they're looking at our roots, but it's pre-altered man.
Yes.
Not man. And all the speculations about that culture, are they relatively accurate?
Relatively.
That
the problem with this is there's the modernistic view. There's the overlay of a modernistic view, etc., not realizing that these charitably said animals were animals.
Yeah, now did they have fire? Did they make fire?
In the early stages, no.
When is this? What is the dating on a stage when it did?
It's not the dating. It's, you see, fire itself can exist under a considerable number of circumstances. There is what's called occasional fire, which would be from lightning strikes, forest fire, and the like. Long-term fire, burning bogs and the like. You see.
What about flint made fire?
Flint made fire was much to the later part. Mostly it was friction fire. That was learned. Friction fire was learned.
What would be a dating on that?
was about... $30,000.
Right, so they talk about our... The traditional, the modernist view is that, you know, we had fire like 100,000 B.C. and we had death rituals and all this stuff. Modern scholars would be shocked at how recent man is and how primitive the... how animal-like the Neanderthal man was.
Yes.
We're projecting back to 60,000 B.C. and 80,000, a culture that did not exist.
Exactly.
They were the animal or the Garden of Eden state that we talked about.
Yes. You see... Fire was, not that it was uncontrollable, but it was as much a esotericness as quantum physics is in this time. You see, if you look at fire, from just the aspect of fire, fire existed, but, and if a fire started, could be continued. But if you lost that fire, how could you reclaim it?
And they almost only reclaim it with flint in the later stages accidentally. Or...
Flint was an accidental discovery in itself. No one sat down and figured this would do this, but noted that there were sparks when flint struck flint. So these things were then flint and metal, but you have to get into a metal society. Understand that in those early portions of this, fire was and fire wasn't. And if fire was, then you kept fire. But if you lost fire, it became almost a political situation, where would you get fire? Fire was there. There were some fires that burned for 15, 20 years and longer.
That they would live around.
That they were themselves would keep, yes. And that it was a constant tending of this. That this was just as food, just as all this, fire was there. Fire was basically, you know, you see, when there is a description of a basic use of fire, the first thing comes to mind is cooking. But in actuality, it's not. The cooking is a later portion of this. Most of the foods they ate were raw. But fire was light, was heat. You see?
Right, and so, and this was man that was not man. They did not have memory or subconscious. A very instinctive animal level of life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at certain birds that exist today, certain of those birds use tools. They would pick a stick up with their beak, and they use that to pry out food. You see?
Now, I understand. Yeah.
Now, this is a function that the genotype bird, that particular branch of the genotype, passes on hardwired to the generation that follows that this is a tool. This is a hardwired tool. If you were to raise a set of chicks away from a mother that used a tool, they will still gravitate to a tool. It's hardwired there.
All right.
Now, in the early man, this was not hardwired. It was not even thought out, but that it existed.
But this is man, not man.
This is man, not man.
Neanderthal man, it was not hardwired.
No.
It wasn't even thought out.
No.
But it becomes hardwired before the alteration?
Things become more hardwired, become less hardwired, become more optional. You see, where a mind has one section that is hardwired, obviously, there are certain things that need to be hardwired. Breathing, autonomic functions of the body, etc. You do not need to think about circulation. Circulation is existing. Now, those early days, that percentage of hardwiring was more than 90% of the brain.
Before the altering.
Before the altering.
Yes.
Now, proportionally, the brain had to be done. But if you look at necessity as the mother of invention, that is only part of the story. Because the Neanderthals still had necessities that Cro-Magnon would have. Eat, live, etc. All of those things associated with daily activity for survival. But it's more than this. If you give a tool, then that tool will change the direction that the society, even to the construct physically, to the extent mentally, be changed. You give a tool of knowing how to use the thumb, how the jaw can alter. You see?
That's the first tool. The altering is the first Atlantis.
That's the first tool.
Yeah.
You see, well, you have opposing thumbs, you use opposing thumbs. But if you look at the opposing thumb of some primates, you'll see it's not the same opposing thumb that you have. It's a different position on the palm of the hand, different, and not used as a thumb. It's used as a finger that is offset from other fingers. It's not used as a thumb.
Yes.
And if you see how that primate uses his hand, you'll see that he uses his hand differently. Now, if you alter the jaw construct, that then there are different functions that can be performed by the teeth after the change than before, then you've changed the direction of that. That society will grow. You will change it.
Yes. All right, now I understand that. So this offering happens only in Africa. Then the Budians nurture this for over 2 years, or during a two-year period, lift these altered Neanderthals to other parts of the world, right?
Yes.
Now, new life begins in these other parts of the world, new man life.
New man life. Which one survived? The point is, if you're going to try an experiment of such magnitude, you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket.
So did all the locations survive?
No. Some didn't. Some did.
Were some of the locations in other parts of Africa?
Some.
So it is accurate to view that the stream of man's history in general comes out of Africa in terms of the survival of the altered apes?
Yes.
But there is life popping up in other parts of the world at that time?
No. Understand that man comes from one stock. Life does not pop up.
No, I meant the altered deposited apes in other parts of the world. They did not survive.
Some did not.
Oh, some did, though.
Some did, some didn't. Some progressed, some didn't.
But the majority comes out of Africa, in terms of streaming into Asia?
Yes.
And then that leads to the area known as Lemuria, and a civilization blossoms there from 18,000 to 14,000.
Yes.
BC. But from 27,000 to 18,000, this primitive Cro-Magnon man is developing civilization in the Middle East and Asia towards the Pacific.
Yes.
And not much is happening in South America or anywhere else.
Some, but none. Some of those that moved to that continent did not survive.
Any that did survive in other continents that were moved from away from Africa, did any of their stock survive? Did they die out eventually.
Some died out. Some could not use the tools they'd been given. Some did not know what the tools were for. They did not know how to use and oppose them. It was a convenience, but it did not create in that particular environment the results that that were expected. So they did not survive.
So as the stream develops through Asia and heads toward Lemuria, that stream is not going to meet with deposited altered Cro-Magnon man in other parts of the world.
Not until much, much, much later.
Oh, so some that did survive in other parts of the world did meet up again, meet up with the original ancestors.
Oh, yes, indeed.
So there was some survival. Where were those areas of survival?
Basically, South America. The part, if you look, that Lemuria itself, when that civilization crashed, there were those that did move to South America, the northern portion of South America.
Yeah, that's in the reading, and that's before they go back to Lemuria and then have the earthquake.
Yes. But still, they met with those elsewhere that were able to reach northern South America.
Yeah, they met these ones that had been deposited by the Boodians and grew up in South America.
Yes.
Were there any other meetings of that anywhere else, or those were the two meetings?
Those are the two that have the most important.
Right. Now, what's the exact date on before the earthquake, but when the Lemurians had their fight and left as the civilization collapsed due to friction? When's the date of that leaving Lemurian area?
Approximately
14,000 B.C.
Yes.
And the earthquakes happened about in Lemuria.
Later than this.
And 13,000 or 12,000?
Within 13 and 12. Within 13, actually.
Right. So the Lemurians they go to South America and North America, and then they go across North America and end up in what's known as Atlantis around Bimini.
Some. Not all.
But there's no civilization on Atlantis until Lemurians plant it.
Until the Lemurians plant it, yes. That's
yes.
A good description.
In a way.
Yes.
And then Atlantis developed a whole new kind of culture. That Atlantis.
Yes.
Which goes from, say, 14,000, 15,000 B.C. to 10,000 B.C. I guess we'd have to go up after they leave Lemuria in 14,000, right?
Yes.
So from 14,000 to 10,000 is the beginnings, in general, of Atlantis.
Yes.
As we know it around Bimini.
Yes.
And then it has its disaster. All right. That clarifies it. Now, Easter Island, therefore, was built by Lemurians?
Descendants of.
And Lemuria, was that a huge continent in the Pacific Ocean?
No, it was large, but it was not very large.
Yet, Hawaii, Indonesia, those Pacific Micronesian islands are part of that?
The Micronesians, yes.
Are part, and Hawaii too.
Yes, but even then, it was not one continuous landmass. It was traversed landmass. Water kept certain portions of it apart, but there were seafarers.
Right, but Lemuria itself as a continent was more where Hawaii is? Or more where Micronesia is?
It was Micronesia.
I see. And Easter Island was built by civilization after Lemuria collapsed?
Yes.
All right. So that's good to get. So there is this general drift of coming from Africa, going to Asia, going to Lemuria, going to North and South America, and then Atlantis, and then into Egypt.
Yes.
Which then it kind of goes full circle. Because
yes.
We come back to Egypt and Africa.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right. So
when they returned, you see, if we take all of the changed peoples, do not put on this a modern belief of that they all progressed at the same speed. Some of them, in actuality, deteriorated and died. Some of them maintained a certain lifestyle. Certain others advanced. So when returning to Egypt, there were changed people, but not gone that far from the roots that they began. That they were still slash and burn thinking. There was still problems with population, etc., tribal warfare, and so on.
The Atlanteans stood out, and they're the ones that came to Egypt from an advanced state to a more primitive Egyptian society.
Exactly.
Right. If when one dies, can one see all this when one looks at what's called the Akashic Records?
Yes.
Do you have to be a relatively evolved person, in quotes, who understands the death process to know how to see the Akashic Records?
No. It's there to be seen.
I mean, it's like a big movie theater. You walk in and you can see it.
Yes.
If you have not fallen asleep, which some people do when they die.
Which is only a temporary state in any event.
And then you're waking up and then you walk into the theater and you
see. If you want to.
It's like you understand there's a button to push to see the video of the history.
Or you see it as it's happening.
Oh, really? And you can look back. And you can
No, you do not look back. You go to the time and watch it actually evolve and evolve and unwrap in front of your eyes.
So you just have to think the thought of what you want to go to, and you see it.
Yes. Time is not a constraint. You see, you do not need to know to have a movie theater. What you need is to go to the time and see it.
And you're like a sponge. You just absorb in with it that hologram and see it.
It's not a hologram. It's real.
Right. It's real, but it's not in physical terms. It's some kind of...
It's real.
Is it real the way we see reality here?
Yes.
No different?
None at all.
We have bodies in that zone?
No, you're the observer.
The observer experiences.
Yes.
And that observer is not just one life.
No, it's the observer that has a number of lives and is cognizant of his lives, and for some reason you may want to investigate a certain time, but you've investigated it between other lives in any event.
Right.
So you may choose, but you'll see what you've already seen before. But it's happening as you see it happen.
Yes. And you can see the future.
Past, present, future. What's the difference?
I was just going to say, it's a very strange mechanism when one is born and forgets all this. When you come into this dimension,
because it is in certain aspects, it does not have relevance.
All right, this is a dimension to do one thing, to focus on one life and do something within that area of problem.
If you look at a multi-room school, where you do know that the child is going to go from grade one, grade two, etc., upwards, learns more, and you know what it's like to be in grade 12, but it has no relevance to yourself at grade 1. So therefore, since it does not have relevance, then it's forgotten.
Right. Now, is it, what happens when, if people heard this information and believed it, will that alter, does it have relevance to know these facts that we're getting through the evergreens about our history in this dimension?
Yes, it does in certain ways. But, you see, to see where you came from is useful. It does not always say where you're going to go. But if you can see where you came from, it gives you a good idea where you can go. Now, it becomes then an argument. If you were to look back at proto-man...
Which is man, not man.
Man, not man. Then you take a good look at Neanderthal. Then you take a good look at Cro-Magnon. And you look at the time taken to go from one position to another position. And then you look at what has happened in the past 200 years. And you see what has happened in the past 100. Then the past 50. And you see that at one time, mankind had to learn the pools of the opposed thumb and the jaw. Had to. Now it's a different matter. one time had to be lung, and now in this present time is not a great constraint, then could there be a rethinking of what man can do? At one time, theologically, man's progress was dictated by that which God would grant, period. Not man, but God. In this time, one does not go to a particular structure to pray for an invention and have the permission to have an idea. And sociologically, that has shifted considerably.
Yes. Now, is proto-man Neanderthal equal to a Neanderthal man?
Some ways, yes. Mostly, no.
What is proto-man, as the Evergreens mean it?
Proto-man was the beginning of that which became man.
That little lemur, L-E-M-U-R, kind of creature that was,
yes,
around the dinosaurs?
Yes.
That the Buddhians saw as a flexible animal that could become?
Yes.
Did they alter it at that point, or just notice it?
They noticed it.
And that's what you mean by proto-man?
Yes.
All right. All right. I'd like to go into the particulars then, since you've given that general overview. In New York, it's very interesting. They have such a variety of programs on public access, and there's one on UFOs, and they have a lot of the Aquarian alternative kind of things, and very interesting artifacts show up. And one of them is called the Stones of Ica in Peru. Do you ever need to know what the Stones of Ica are?
Yes.
They're something that some people there have found, and they hide them away from the public. They're scholars of it. And I think they date it back to 10,000, 14,000 B.C.
Yes.
Well, what are they and where did they come from?
They came from those who moved to the area at the time. Notice the timing of it. Who left their mark. It's the best description of it.
But are they Lemurians?
Yes.
When the Lemurians finally left after their cataclysm?
Yes.
They came and they brought some of their artifacts?
Yes.
So they're actually Lemurian artifacts?
Yes.
Of the highest state of Lemurian culture, so to speak?
Yes.
But I don't understand why you specify leave your mark. I think of there's the whole controversy of the plains of Nazca. You're not talking about those kind of marks.
No, not that. The Ica stones themselves.
Why do you say, in quotes, they left their mark, as if it was such a dramatic meaning?
Because if you're going to leave a souvenir of yourself, it's going to have to survive.
Right, but they were living there. They didn't think they were going to disappear.
They did not know what.
In their anxiety of what had they gone through.
Exactly.
So they left it for the local people?
They left it. The local people found it. But you realize, it's not so hard and sharp a division.
Right, because the Lemurians breed with the
Peruvians.
Exactly. Peruvian. Yeah, so it was part of the new Peruvian culture that the Lemurians brought.
Yes.
And was it kept by priests, since they understood it was about, seemed to be precious?
Invariably, there's always a breakdown into divisions of those who would have a particular function, and yes. You may call them priests, but in actuality, they're for the keepers.
Did it get lost and somebody found it in the 20th century, or was it preserved all through those thousands of years?
Been preserved through all those years.
By certain Inca tribes?
No, sometimes it's been lost and sometimes it's been found again.
By individuals?
By individuals.
And have they lost the knowledge of where, the ones who have it now, do they know it comes from Lemuria?
No, they don't know where it comes from.
Right. But it alters the dating of our evolution in modernist history.
It does.
Yeah, I understand. So, I don't remember what ICA, ICA stands for. Is that the place?
It's a place.
Yes. All right. Now, I have in brackets dinosaurs and UFOs. I can't remember why. There was no, there's no booty in artifact of Stone's Vega. It's purely Lemurian evolution.
Purity, yes.
Now, was there a person named Homer in Greek history?
Yes, there was.
Was there more than one?
Yes, but it's almost a saying, no, it wasn't written by Homer, it was written by another person called Homer. There'd have been. It's a popular name.
Right, but there was... And did he write or speak what we now have as the Homer writings?
Yes. Oh, there's been amendments. There's been editing. That was fairly accurate.
Homer wrote it.
Homer wrote it, yes.
Because some scholars say that the culture was oral back then, and whoever Homer was someone who would chant the poetry. And it wasn't written till generations later.
Mm. You see, in an oral society... The memory of those words is imperative. Now, if you would say the poetry was passed from generation to generation by those whose purpose was to memorize it, it's not a point who put it down on paper, or to what media is more permanent, but that you would be surprised how permanent the chanted media is.
So why did this one individual write it down?
Because it needed to be written down.
Not because it was being forgotten?
No, not because it was being forgotten. Just a method of teaching. Teaching methods changed, but the objective of the original writing was not to put aside memory, but to enhance it.
Yeah, like not a visual aid.
That would be a good description.
Right.
But the ultimate was not for writing. The ultimate was for memory.
Right. So for chanting, for oral performance.
For oral performance.
So who created those ballads that were passed down through generations?
Homer. And there have been certain additions to it, yes, but mostly Homer.
He created the oral, then someone else wrote it down.
Yes.
When did Homer create the two stories, the Iliad and the Odyssey, as he chanted? When did he start chanting those stories?
It's approximately, what is that date? It is before. We don't have the exact date. One moment. Approximately 700 years before the birth of Christ.
And it's after the battles that it's based on.
Yes.
So it's a historical oral culture celebration of.
Yes.
So let's say it's approximately 700 BC. When was it written down?
To 350 years before the coming of the Nazarene.
Right. All right. So
understand also that in certain circles, writing it down was wrong.
Within the same culture?
Within the same culture.
At the time of Homer?
After. At the time of writing, that writing would be done, would be... Writing was the symbolism that had to be learned as to its, how it would be pronounced. And so that this would then be able to be carried across a distance. But even then, the messenger would have the stories in his mind, that what if the messenger was to be harmed? And what if the story would be changed by another group? Which was oftentimes done. So it affected change. Now those who were in the oral tradition did not change what they heard.
The writing caused this changing problems you just said.
It was feared that it would. Because if it is written and then said, it would alter because of the writing. So therefore the writing itself was considered almost a blasphemy. So writing was not right.
And what's the timing on that conflict? The dates of that era of conflict?
Conflict of writing was from the approximately 500 years before the coming of the Nazarene to approximately 500 years after the coming of the Nazarene.
So it did take place, this conflict was experienced in Athens?
It was experienced everywhere. Understand what the oral tradition means and how important the oral tradition was and how much time and effort went into this. It was the people's learning.
Yeah.
It was the secret learning of others. Certain oral histories were passed down from generation to generation under strict observance that only the direct family would know them. So they were private, they were public, they were commercial. Now, let us take one modern example of this. And it may seem facetious, but please let us carry through with it. The 285 rules of acquisition by the Ferengi. Now, obviously that this is fiction.
Is that something now? I don't know what this is you're referring to.
It's from the Star Trek Deep Space Nine series.
Oh yeah, I don't see much of that. So that's a story.
There's a character in that show that belongs to a particular race known as the Ferengi.
Okay.
And they are traders. And they have 285 rules of acquisition that are passed down generation after generation. Now, why would the writer of the show put this in, but that it would be an oral tradition? The oral tradition, as far as the Western world is concerned, has been taken over by writing. To the detriment of what could be the oral tradition. Because writing gives you the opportunity to go beyond what was said and comment what was said. When you live in an oral tradition where you cannot question the oral saying, there's very little criticism. Now, which was said about Plato and others was that their approach to criticism was in effect saying that the oral tradition was finished.
Plato said that.
That he, by what he did,
yeah,
was to form critiques, form alternate possibilities. The oral tradition is designed so that there is no change.
Was Plato aware of the effects that he would do to the oral tradition when he wrote?
Not completely. Not completely.
Now, did you want to develop... Now, how does this relate to the Star Trek story?
The point is that the Ferengi have 285 rules of acquisition. In one particular episode, they talk of the various rules, and one of the younger Ferengi says, but I have to learn 285. You only had to learn 220. So the point is that the oral tradition is expanding, so therefore became an inherent part of the society. That oral tradition that you talk of the Greeks and early Greeks, oral tradition was to form a finality. We wish to draw attention to the difference between the two.
And that was what you were pointing out.
Yes.
The oral tradition as laid out in the Star Trek series is a different oral tradition.
Yes.
Understanding the benefits of additions of writing.
Yes.
More flexible.
Much more flexible. In those early periods, in the Greeks, it was so inflexible.
I understand. So that's what McLuhan would call the services of the alphabet. It created new flexibility.
It did.
I'm going to go back further. Doesn't sound familiar to me. It may be done, but we got to go like this.
Him. But that it would be an oral tradition. The oral tradition, as far as the Western world is concerned, has been taken over by writing. To the detriment of what could be the oral tradition. Because writing gives you the opportunity to go beyond what was said and comment what was said. When you live in an oral tradition where you cannot question the oral saying, there's very little criticism. That which was said about Plato and others was that their approach to criticism was in effect saying that the oral tradition was finished.
Plato said that.
That he, by what he did,
yes,
was to form critiques, form alternate possibilities. The oral tradition is designed so that there is no change.
Was Plato aware of the effects that he would do to the oral tradition when he wrote?
Not completely. Not completely.
Now, did you want to develop... Now, how does this relate to the Star Trek story?
The point is that the Ferengi have 285 rules of acquisition. In one particular episode, they talk of the various rules. And one of the younger Ferengi says that I have to learn 285. You only had to learn 220. So, point is that the oral tradition is expanding. So, therefore, became an inherent part of the society. That oral tradition that you talk of, the Greek and early Greeks, oral tradition was to form a finality. We wish to draw attention to the difference between the two.
And that was what you were pointing out?
Yes.
The oral tradition as laid out in the Star Trek series is a different oral tradition.
Yes.
Understanding the benefits of additions of writing.
Yes.
More flexible.
Much more flexible. In those early periods, in the Greeks, it was so inflexible.
I understand. So that's what McLuhan would call the services of the alphabet. It created new flexibility.
It did.
Now, with electric tactility, we're balanced eye, ear, plus the flexibleness of the tactile effect.
But does that open up so much?
Yeah.
It destroys tradition. Tradition is...
You
what?
Mean today?
Yes.
What was your last word? Tradition is...
Tradition is what? In California, tradition is we did it last year.
Can we pause 1 second, please?
Okay. I'm going to move it forward. This second. That was the end of
it's type one.
Okay, if you do it, now comes side two on the old cassette.
Okay, please continue.
In Europe, tradition is 200 years, 300 years. China, 1,000. So, what What is tradition in a society that has linked its interfaces, its words, its thoughts, its tactile, its sensoriness, which incidentally is changing that part of the brain called the sensorium, that there are various methodologies in which one views this world. What is happening to tradition?
Well, it's an apocalypse, yes?
Some would say that the movement of certain historians to what other historians would say is a revisionist state. The past can be seen from the perspective of not truth. What's history? What's history?
Well, I don't want to explore this too much. I have a bunch of questions I want to...
Please.
But you're pointing out that... I would say that, you know, tradition is, in all the different cultures, are going through apocalypse. It's being wiped out. We're becoming something totally new.
Yes.
And that's the tactile effect. The tactile goes beyond the oral tradition and the visual tradition.
It does indeed.
And that's what I think of an old reading by the Evergreens. They define the Second Coming as a time of perpetual change.
Yes.
That, to me, is tactile culture.
Good.
So if we can end on that theme, unless
yes.
You wanted to add.
No, please continue.
Because there are particular details of history. What did the, and this is just a legend, what did the oracle say to Alexander? Apparently we don't know what the oracle said to Alexander the Great.
In essence, what the oracle said was, you will reach your goal and die there.
And Alexander was shocked to hear that?
Yes.
And so it became a secret?
Yes.
And that's why we don't know.
Exactly.
I see. What happened, what actually happened in the temple of Demeter? I have in brackets exotic or erotic images. I'm not sure why I have the question. Something went on in the temple of Demeter, the details we're not sure of.
Understand what the temple is for. Fecundity.
For making babies?
Yes.
You mean it was part of the prostitution cult?
Holy prostitution.
Yeah, sacred prostitution.
Sacred prostitution.
So
but also, understand the necessity of children. The necessity. Not just need of children. To perpetuate a race, but to perpetuate the parents' children. So therefore, you wanted good, healthy children. So what did you do? You conceived in a place that would say that there would be good, healthy children.
You mean you went in with your wife and conceived in there?
Yes.
And
if not this month, next month. And so on and so on.
It wasn't that you had people making love to other women to make babies.
Some, yes.
Like it was a productive brothel, so to speak.
Yes. If they were within the tribe, yes. Not outside.
So you could have married couples perform in there or unmarried producing as many children as possible.
Yes.
And the women were the high priestesses of this.
They were the priestesses, yes.
All right. When was in one of the old readings...
The great mathematic.
Yeah, when was it obliterated? When was this battle? Was it before the Roman Empire or after?
Before.
And after Athens or before Athens?
Before.
Can you give a time when these battles, when the great math got beat up by people who wouldn't tolerate the great math anymore?
You see, when mathematics reaches a point that it is predictable, then it reaches a point in certain cultures where it's perceived as a magic.
You mean they don't understand it?
Not that they don't understand. It's the result that they do not understand.
even though they can do it. They can use it to make their predictions accurate.
Yes, but others, not so well conversed in it, would say this is a magic.
So then that became a bad name to be magic?
Yes. Magic had a very hard time of it.
And when did this begin? 1000 B.C.?
Earlier than this.
2000 B.C.?
Between the two, 15.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the Western bias against magic, I guess.
Yes. You see, what is 2 times 9?
11. Or 2 9 2 9 is 18, right?
Now, to some, that's magic. Who did you consult in your mind to give you the answer? Is that a profitable God or an unprofitable God that gave you the answer? Do you have other answers? Who in your head talks to you to tell you that this building will stand or not stand, or that you can position yourself accurately? And the great mathematic was seen as just another oral tradition that was kept within certain families. And once those families were set upon, destroyed, the mathematic ended. So did, people believed, the evil that gave those answers. Certain people to this day say there are certain things you should not know. And of course, that thinking is going. We consider a society that would have that as a certain basic core belief of its own existence is you learn of something, it will destroy you, because it would have an energy associated with it that would kill you, or lead you astray, or cause your cattle to die, or cause your family to have illness.
I see. I'd like to move on to, now the Knights Templar are rumored to have secret sex magic cults, that they would drink each other's urine or engage in homosexual practices. This would be, I guess, around 1000 A.D. Is that a rumor in the occult world, or is it a fact?
It's a rumor.
The Knights Templar did not have a sex magic cult?
No, not at all.
And therefore, John Donne's poetry is the man who wrote around the time of Shakespeare, a little after, he does not have sex magic embedded in his poetry?
No.
All right. Is there a man or woman in history who had, which man, woman in history had the most sexual partners in one lifetime? Can that be tabulated?
Modern or ancient?
In all time, though cultures could be different. I mean, if these people in the Temple of Demeter are having sex all the time and making babies, and they had many partners. But is there someone, they don't have to be someone we know in history, but is there someone who stands out who had, 25,000 sex partners or something in life, in one lifetime?
No. There is in the year 1157 one individual says he has a sexual partner for every day of his life.
And that's AD?
That's AD.
Well, what culture was that?
To Spain.
Of
his life. You take all of the days of his life.
And how many years did he or she live?
63. So multiply it out.
Was it a woman?
Male.
And this is before puberty?
No, he began his sexual experiences at puberty.
So he had more than one a day?
No, he had one a day.
That was his average for his lifetime.
So 50 times 300, is that 1,500 or 15,000?
63 years, yeah. Multiplied by 365.
Anyway, we'll work at that out later, unless you have the answer. I can't, is that 18,000 or 1,800? Oh, you're doing it.
Yes.
And that's 63 after they become 12 years old, or 63?
Of all of the days of his life, come to more than 2,000 days. 22,000. And in that time, he had from his age 11 to his death at 63, he had 22,000 sexual experiences.
What kind of, was he a rich person? How could he be in a situation to do that?
One of the groups says he travels a lot.
He wasn't a prostitute?
Not at all.
Was he handsome? Did he have sexual charisma? And could seduce somebody every day?
He would have a certain technique. His technique was this, and we'll give you exactly what he says. Every woman he met, he acted as if he had already made love with her. And that the first time they made love, in actuality, he treated as if it were the second time.
And he could fool the women into thinking they had.
No, did not fool them. It's just his attitude. His attitude was, we've already done it, let's do it again.
And they...
mentally, but he never said those words out. Mentally.
He was kind of like a hypnotist.
Not a hypnotist. It was his own ethic. His ethic was, always approach a woman in your mind. You hold the belief that this is going to be the second time. We've adapted that earlier in talking of companionship and friendship. Always treat the person you meet as if you've met them before. But he originated this with, if you're going to make love with somebody, act as if it's the second time.
And the Evergreens would agree that he probably had the most care. People.
He was somewhat handsome. He was somewhat sexually evolved in certain ways, but he was of average size physically. His genitals were no bigger than anyone else. Average in all ways, or every way. But the point is, his attitude with women was that he'd already made love with them, even though he hadn't. So he treated women differently.
Would he be considered a genius and originator of that attitude?
He was one of the first to try it.
There have been others since?
Well, there have been many since.
Yes. But the Evergreens would say nobody has equaled the number of people he's had.
No.
All right.
Sexual experiences, could some of them been a repeat?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Right. And would he always ejaculate inside the woman or not? Would he take contraceptive measures?
He had contraceptive methods, a sheath.
Yes. All right. I'd like to go back to St. Paul, one of the founders of Christianity.
Yes. Approximately 2 minutes.
What is the story about him being converted as Saul on the road to Damascus true?
Not totally true. Not totally.
Was he the character, as we know him historically, who did have an experience?
He was changed. His beliefs changed. It was not as dramatic as some would have it said. It was not just one total conversion process. Understand, that he was accomplished in his field. He had traveled, he met many people. And the more he traveled, the more that he changed certain of his beliefs.
As he was a tax collector.
Yes. But the point of hearing what the Nazarene said made sense. When something made sense at such a deep level as it made sense inside himself, then he knew that they would need for this to be told to others. Once again, let's go to the point of oral transmission. But what he got was not the writings of the Nazarene. He got the oral tradition. You see, with an oral tradition, you have nothing on yourself that would incriminate you. No writings that could be attributed to a particular group or a particular problem area. It's all in your head. Johnny Mnemonic.
Yes.
Now, so therefore, understand that Paul wanted this to be told, and so therefore constructed Christianity.
The written version.
The written version.
Was he told of Jesus' ability to do miracles?
Yes.
And did he believe it?
Yes.
And it was imparted orally strong enough that one would believe it?
Yes.
Because these were witnesses?
Yes.
And then he decided that's an ancient battle in Christianity, whether it should have stayed with the oral tradition and Peter or to go with the written tradition and Paul.
Yes.
And that's a true battle that happened.
It was the battle of battles.
More seriously than we realize.
Far more.
So the Paul, he wanted to convert it to, like Plato, to writing, and this upset the oral keepers.
Indeed.
And yet, why did he win out then?
Because the world was ready for writing.
And what is the time of, are we accurate on the dates of his life?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's at that time.
Yes.
And the Roman Empire was there to spread the writing.
Because the Romans were beginning to realize that the oral tradition was good in a society that didn't necessarily move as much as Romans did. Rome spread itself across the continent. The Holy Roman Empire was a magnificence of roads, a magnificence of travel. And writing fits a cooler environment.
Not in McLuhan terms, writing is a hot medium, to be exact.
Writing is a hot, and oral is cool.
So you stand by what you said, writing fits a cooler environment?
Writing fought, the word is fought, the cooler environment.
Yes.
Hot versus cool. Cool cannot win when the society is moving so fast towards hot. Even now, radio taken over by television.
Yeah, radio is oral and cooler. Television is considered cooler, but it is not oral. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
And so the oral culture dies in the 20th century. The radio dies because TV subsumes it.
So what comes next? Back tactile.
Which is a totally new situation, unless it's in some ways, the Atlanteans at 10,000 BC were considered tactile because they had an understanding of resonance.
Yes.
But not like our tactile. We're in a totally new tactile.
Exactly.
That's what's new. Now, has Marshall been guiding this reading a lot?
He's observing. What he's observing is that, and this must end on this, he says, never thought of asking who done it more than anyone else. Interesting.
Talking about me?
No. That a person would devote their entire life to screwing women is what Marshall says.
That he never thought
that anyone would ask such a question
of you guys.
Yes.
He's talking about me.
He's talking questions.
I'm coming up with original questions from Mervyn.
You are indeed. And now this must end.
Thank you, Evergreen. So unless there's any final comment or further comment, shall we end the session?
Please.
Thank you. Dear Lord, please enfold these entities in thy love and thy perfection. Amen. Please clear any negative influences from these entities now.
Amen.
Allow the body to become completely relaxed. Perform any healing which may need to be performed. Begin increasing the blood pressure to normal, naturally. And begin returning all other systems of the body to normal, naturally now.
Amen.
And thank you for our sessions, and fairly well.
We do thank you. To you both. God's blessing.
Thank you, and same to you. Now, I would like Michael to awaken, feeling completely refreshed, relaxed, and loved now. Okay, go ahead.
You know, if you can say that you've had sex for every day of your life, as an average, well, some days you'd have to make love to around about 50, 60 people.
Oh, you mean to average it out?
To the average
yeah.
it out.
I hadn't thought of that. Oh, yeah,
I thought of that.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And what this guy did was, he did obviously a fair amount of traveling, but his thing about making love to a lot of women was his stamina was, good Lord, incredible.
He's like a yogi or a figure.
Almost. A lot of the time, he didn't even come. A lot of the time, it was just a mechanical. It was no ejaculation.
He
didn't.
He had used it up for a while.
No, he just didn't.
Oh, he didn't concentrate on that.
No, that didn't happen. And
he enjoyed tactility. Think of the metaphor. He enjoyed the tactile. He wasn't goal-oriented. he wasn't visual.
After a while, he got, if he didn't have five women that day, and how in the hell you arrange that is as difficult as hell, but it sounds almost like that number is suspect because of some guy boasting about it. But they were going to say, no, this guy made love that many times. Not to that many people, because he was with one woman and they were making love on, ten times a day.
And right. We might have to qualify how many women.
Yes.
Assuming it's women.
And it probably comes down to much less.
But if you have 10,000.
Yeah.
10,000 people. In that sense, we didn't really get the answer. We're going to have to check that.
Yeah. And, you know.
But he certainly had a lot of sex.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Trying to wear the damn thing out.
And he certainly didn't remain faithful. And it just occurs to me now, that's the time of the troubadours. The famous love. That might have been part of that troubadour love world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It was a one-man Pocatelli.
Yeah. Really.
Yeah.
Who's Pocatelli?
Another festival
in
the Navajo
tradition.
Navajo.
All right. But this could be, in other words, what's it called? The what's the tradition called? You know, you're charitable to women. The age of
chivalry.
Chivalry.
Yeah.
This guy could have been the pop star. The Mick Jagger riding in on a bed of people having sex in that period. Mm-hmm. Did you hit that lady, what's her name, ran around nude in Jerusalem? I can't. Famous queen. I forget right now who she was, but she was married to King John and created the king. She created many kings. Since then, he's waiting. I can't remember the character. And Joseph Campbell talks a lot about it.
But you know, one thing is that there was that. What I was fascinated by was this is fascinating, and I don't know enough about it to really talk about it. But Ellie and her calculator take her back a couple of thousand years, and she's got her little calculator with her, you know, the little Radio Shack calculator.
What do you mean, take her back?
We take her back in history. We take Ellie back.
Oh, in your reading?
No, right now. We do this. We have a time machine.
Oh, okay.
And we can take Ellie and her calculator back. Ellie and her calculator, if she used it, within a week would be dead.
Because, they would get rid of it.
Oh, they would get rid of it. And her. Because...
yeah.
And And see, the some of the, you know, some people are, some kids these days, you know, are so good with math, you know. You take that kid back, and that kid, too, would be killed, usually stoned.
And that's a characteristic of oral culture, Mark used to say. They're ecological. They would not allow new technology to come in.
No.
The tactile world we're in now, the new tactile, allows new content.
New content.
Yeah.
But new content and new media.
Yeah, new media.
We're not so media derisive.
We're not, not brought back the oral culture in that sense. Which many people on a simple...
That's
music. Yeah. You know, in a sense, music is what Coker calls the hologram, a coherency for people. It's background coherency, because we can't really see a tactile environment. We're feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
But many people think on the cliche level that McLuhan celebrated the oral culture and bring back their culture. No, he talked about the tactile new.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things about the oral culture was that, and the immigrant said, if you don't believe in the oral culture, what songs did you sing when you were a kid? Ellie, what songs did you sing when you were skipping? You had a skip rope. And salt, mustard, vinegar, pepper. You know. Yeah.
Are you saying we're supposed to? I don't get
you. No, you remember all those things that you sang as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And they get passed on. No, you see kids out in the playground, and they're singing songs that Ellie's...
Yeah, but they might be 500 years old. Both.
Yeah, some of them. Yeah. Yeah. And Mary, Mary, quite contrary. How'd you garden? And they were social comments when they were done originally and went through that whole thing. But they stick around for their social memes. Let's just stay there. And if we said to our kids, you can't learn any new ones, kids go, what? What do you mean? And you say, well, no, if you learn any of them, you will be beaten strongly. And the kids would just say, well, you know, but before, these kids learned epics. They learned at their parents' knee. They learned...
And they wouldn't learn new things. They had enough to learn.
They had enough to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about the real oral
tradition. The real oral tradition.
But they were conservative. They would not take any new in.
No. And then there was the family one. The family one. But what I particularly liked was that the tanner's kids would learn a tanning song. And the tanning kids would learn it from their father that how to scrape the hide, how to
whistle while you work.
They would learn.
By singing.
They'd learn it, and they'd how to get the skin off, and how to make the right cuts so you get the biggest piece of leather possible, how to scrape the skin, what to soak it in, and that was proprietary information. We do not let anybody know how that's done.
Right.
The tanner's vats were, they usually did most of their work in the very early dawn with the family watch and standing guard at the gates, so making sure nobody comes in to see their formulas. And you did not give your tanner song out to the anybody. It was strictly verboten, like the formula for Coke. You know, our family knows it. Nobody else knows it.
But the point is, the children would learn this through singing. That's how they could learn better, faster.
They learn it through singing, and also through meter, of the
right.
Da 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 da.
And you saw this.
Saw that. But the other one was, it's interesting how that progressed in. To incantations, that the people who learned how to make a tanning solution from the song, other people would do that on other things too, and you learned incantations, and that's where incantations come from, an old oral.
I'm not sure what you're saying. Not the tanners, other people.
Other people.
But incantation is singing. What do you mean by incantation?
Well, okay, if you take the witch's incantations, and the most famous one is the three witches in Shakespeare. Around about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw, told them. That's a formula.
From something.
But he made it up as a witch's thing. But that oral tradition was still hanging on in Shakespeare's time.
Yes, but what is the difference between a tanner's kid learning songs versus incantations.
Well, same thing in a way.
But you were making a point.
I'm making a point is that the oral tradition slowly died out, and the only remnants of it left were incantations.
So the witches were the after oral culture, but the preservers of it, but they weren't truly oral.
Mm-hmm.
That's your point.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, and that's the beginning, that's the effect of writing.
Yeah, the effect of writing. And the other one was...
Now that relates to magic, the whole thing, they've come up magic. Because in other words, our magic, the witch's magic, that whole world that the feminists are bringing back, is a retrieval of late alphabetized oral culture, not really oral.
Not really oral.
Good point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the other one was, I saw... Chupu, you know, that's the knotted strings that the Incas used. They had a string with knots, and the way that the knot was on the string, you could read it by running it through your fingers, and it would give you amounts. And,
is this something I should know, or you?
No, this is what actually exists, and they're called Chupu, a knotted string. And that has a way of imparting information from point A to point B, because it didn't have an alphabet.
Right.
But they did have knots on string. So it seems like if the alphabet didn't exist, there would become a need to invent it.
But wait a minute, when you're talking about the kupu, is that something that normal historians know of?
Oh, yes, they know
of. Okay, you're talking about that.
Yeah.
And you're looking at what this artifact you know of.
Yeah. But they didn't have an alphabet. The Incas did not have an alphabet.
But here's the key, this is the key point. In the Inca tapes, you know, the self-seeing prophecy, those tapes that you did, very key McLuhan point is made in them, I never brought up to you, they never developed the wheel.
Yeah.
And the wheel leads to visual space in McLuhan terms and then writing.
Yeah.
And that's and the alphabet. So you're right, the 10,000, the way back pure Incas, they did not, they developed a magnificent resonant kind of culture because they didn't develop the wheel.
Yeah.
And now you're saying here...
Because they didn't develop...
Kupu is part of that culture?
Part of that culture, yeah. But it's not an alphabet. It's only an indicator of information. It's not an alphabet.
It's tactile, too.
It's tactile, yeah.
Yeah.
But they...
But you made a point about writing, that they would have developed the alphabet.
But if we didn't have the alphabet these days, we'd have to invent it. Somebody would have to come up with... I've come up with this marvelous invention called alphabet.
But that's McLuhan's point, is that the alphabet is the matrix to create the Western dynamism of mechanical culture. It came out of the alphabet.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't have got the mechanism without the alphabet.
No.
So it's not that we wouldn't have to invent it.
Yeah.
But unless you mean something different.
What I mean is, it's an invention. The alphabet was an invention by necessity. We have to have an alphabet. We had to have the transfer of knowledge that... It wasn't that the oral tradition...
But it comes out of the wheel cultures.
Comes out of the wheel cultures, yes.
And leads to that battle against the great mathematic in 1500 B.C. when the wheel cultures starts to take over in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And that leads to a need of writing. Yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah. I see your point.
But
the Incas didn't. See, they were totally different.
They went from a totally different direction.
And probably the Atlanteans, I don't know if they... What they had.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, I don't think they did.
No, they didn't.
Well, this is the key. This is the... But you're on the verge of really understanding McLuhan's point. The alphabet is the only medium that abstracts semantic meaning and letters out of its context.
Yeah. Right.
It's not, and so people, and that's where they could become imperial.
Yeah.
The Greeks could go in and absorb a whole culture, that oral culture, translate it back in a visual, and create empire,
Center
America. And any culture that never did that is not Western, but... When you know the Atlantean and Inca true history, you can understand their psychic, resonant, tactile cultures because they didn't even develop the wheel, which is the beginning of leading to that visual abstraction. And that's what McLuhan was right on, and that's what's important. But you see the point, Ellie?
Yes. Yeah.